This is Ron Frenz, comics illustrator, and this is a bumper for the Amazing Spider Talk.
Too many who know the angles, uncover and untangle all the questions and the webs left out to dangle. Up in 1962, last Wednesday's afternoon, they'll bend your ears with reckless self-abandon. The Amazing Spider-Talk. The Amazing Spider-Talk. Come swing the air, sit back and prepare for the Amazing Spider-Talk. Hello,
I'm Dapper Dan Gavazdin, and I'm the founder and editor of SuperiorSpiderTalk.com.
And I'm mischievous Mark Giannacchio, founder of the Chasing Amazing blog and author of 100 Things Spider-Man Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die.
Thanks for joining us for the third episode of the all-new Amazing Spider Talk. We hope you enjoy this podcast and that it provides an intelligent conversation between two fans and collectors as we look at the Spider-Man comic universe in a bit of a bigger picture.
Yeah, Dan, in this first season of the all-new Amazing Spider Talk, we've been taking a closer look at the Stan Lee and Steve Ditko creative run on Amazing Spider-Man. Last episode, we talked about just who exactly is Parker. So now that we kind of covered that and solved that great mystery, right? I mean, you know, there's no question that we know everything about the character now.
We definitely came to a conclusive end.
Exactly, that he is a man of contradictions. Well, with that being said, now we're going to look at all the things that make him Spider-Man, i.e. his powers, costumes, gadgets, and how they are all first presented by Lee and Ditko. And then we'll talk a little bit about how they evolve kind of in the years that follow that.
Yeah, and a lot of the details we'll be discussing today can be found in the Amazing Spider-Man Annual number 1 in that backup section. So if you want to read along, that's a great place to start, as is almost any comic from the Lee and Ditko run, because they love to use all these gadgets and powers. But of course, you can find a copy of Amazing Spider-Man Annual number 1, which, for the record, definitely counts. You can find it just about anywhere, print, digital, or as part of Marvel's Unlimited service. So whether you've read it a million times or not at all, we hope you enjoy our episode entitled Power, Costumes, Gadgets? Oh my!
It occurred to me that he could naturally shoot webbing, but I foolishly thought that would make him seem too, I don't know, there's something unpleasant about webbing coming out of a guy's hand. I thought by giving him little web shooters that he creates himself, first of all, it would show how brilliant he is. And the best thing about the mechanical web shooters was there would be times when he needed his webs and he ran out. And what is he going to do? And as a writer, it's always great to have a story where you have a great way for your hero to get into trouble.
So, Dan, just right before we get into it, to the annual question, I just want to put out there that my brother gave me my birthday present a few days early this week, and I got a copy of ASM Annual number 3, the Avengers issue, which I do believe I do think it does count. So in terms of owning all of the annuals that actually count in my book, I'm much closer to having everything that counts now.
This is as close of an admission that I'll ever get from you.
There you go. But
I'll take it.
To the point of why people are listening to our show, powers, costumes, gadgets, oh my. Well, you know, let's just say that in the beginning, Peter wasn't exactly an Iron Man yet in terms of his technological know-how and whatnot. But we did get to see from Jump Street some miraculous seamstressing abilities, web shooters, and, of course, just the general power set, which is a lot of fun. So why don't we start with the actual costume? Because, Dan, I know you love costumes. You're dressed up in one right now.
Is that some reference to something I'm not even aware of?
I know. I just know that you love. I think when we were like planning these shows, I was like, yeah, we'll talk about his powers and his gadgets. You're like, and costumes.
You're right. I do. I do love the costume because I think it really is a distinguishing feature of Spider-Man's. I mean, it is a costume unlike any other in comics. I can't think of another costume that has that kind of like texturing on it. Like, who else has something as intricate as webs drawn on their suit?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very intricate suit, and you know, something that I think would be comically butchered over the years, depending on who was drawing the suit, i.e., the Spider-Man 67 animated series, where they would just give up on the webbing halfway through.
I thought you were referencing to Jack Kirby's cover of Strange Tales Annual number 2.
Oh, well, there's that too. But beyond like the texturing and the uniqueness of the costuming, I mean, I think probably one of the most distinguished things that makes Spider-Man Spider-Man, and this was something that was a very deliberate decision from Steve Ditko, is the mask, the full covering mask. And one of the main reasons, you know, while researching the book that I had just wrote and published, that, you know, Ditko talks about in like some of his essays is, you know, he said from the get-go to Stan Lee that he wanted the mask because he wanted something that would make the reader uncomfortable, which in terms of a character named Spider-Man and, you know, the whole thing, we talked about this in episode one, Spider-Man's being, what's his name? Martin Goodman thinking spiders are icky and would offend the crowd, the readers.
Also wanted to make Peter uncomfortable because it's annoying to breathe in that thing.
Yeah, it is. It is. And, you know, like in that annual, in the first annual where they kind of run through all the powers and costumes and stuff, I mean, they talk about how it like, oh, it muffles his face. But, you know, from a less pragmatic standpoint, I mean, Ditko wanted that mask because it's very unnerving. And beyond that, it establishes the fact that anybody, anything can be under that mask. It could be a human, it could be a teenager, it could be an adult, it could be a subhuman, you know what I mean? Like they he wanted to establish the fact that, and obviously it played into the mythos right away with, you know, Spider-Man, Menace, or Hero, or whatever, that anybody could have been under that mask. I mean, to me, it's one of those things that is, we kind of take it for granted now because he is a mask, and you know, everyone, you know, you think of Spider-Man, you think of the mask, but like to actually get into that place where thinking back to how it had to be this very deliberate decision and the rationale behind it, to me, that's a stroke of brilliance.
Yeah, I agree. And it's why you see so many people like cosplaying as Spider-Man or, you know, kids dressing up as Spider-Man for Halloween, because there's an inherent easy ability for you to imagine yourself in that costume. But it comes with, you know, some difficulties as well. Like, once your face is covered up, it's a lot harder to emote, you know, or to draw the character emoting, or in the movie have the character emoting while wearing the mask. That's why you see all those Spider-Man movies where in the final act his mask gets destroyed or taken off and his identity revealed, because they want the character to be able to express himself. And, you know, they recently fixed that with Homecoming. But in the comics, you know, they had to, you know, come up with something. And I think that's probably where those big eyes came in.
Yeah. And you know, Ditko talks about the fact, like, you know, the half Peter, half mask thing that also usually is used for like spider sense and stuff, which we'll get to in a second. I mean, that was kind of Ditko's way of trying to cover some of the emoting as well. And Lee, interesting, I mean, at least according to Ditko, Stan Lee hated the half mask thing because he was just like, you know, what are people seeing both? What is this supposed to mean? You know, like he took it very literally. to your point, you know, that was kind of one of Ditko's workarounds, but it didn't change the fact that, yeah, when the character was fully in mask, it just became more of a challenge to raise the emotional stakes for the character.
Do you want to talk about the eyes? Because they've kind of seen them represented so many different ways in the medium, whether they're, you know, like shutters like they are in the Homecoming movie, or like weird stick-on like sunglasses, mirrors in the other ones. What do you think about these eyes?
Oh, I mean, they're pretty cool. Well, they're described in the first annual as being plastic lenses that work like two-way mirrors. That's the actual, you know, at least how they're initially presented by Lee and Ditko. That's the tangible qualities of the eyes, which is just, you know, kind of begs the question. I mean, you know, the true miracle of miracle for Spider-Man is how the heck did this teenage kid put this costume together?
Yeah.
Furthermore, beyond the seamstressing of it, like, where did he find plastic lenses that work as two-way mirrors? Like, yo, I just had that lying around in my at-home science lab. But it is interesting how, like, over the years, like, I feel like, what, Romita kind of made them bigger, right? Was that?
Yeah.
Is that and then, like, McFarlane kind of riffed on Romita. And it is interesting that they've kind of gotten bigger, gotten smaller. I mean, how do you feel what are, like, the qualities that you like about the eyes of the costume?
Well, I mean, if I were to choose an artist drawing them the best, I think like Bagley and Romita have the best balance in terms of their size. I always felt like Todd's eyes were a little too big, and Eric Larson as well. Like, they kind of took over the face,
right,
which can be appropriate sometimes. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think there's something really neat about, like, they're just this kind of, at least from an artistic sense, they're the only thing white on his costume. So they immediately jump out. You know, like, they're kind of this interesting punctuation to the face mask. And I can't think of another hero who's got, like, his eyes represented in such a large way. So, like, I like it when the eyes emote. I don't know how you feel about it, but some people really don't like when the eyes open and close and stuff. But I think if they're used right, it's a really great way to get into the mind of Peter.
Yeah, I mean, like, not to contradict you, but I that's part of what I like about McFarlane's huge eyes, is because, like, I think it does exaggerate the emotions even more. Like, sad Spider-Man with McFarlane is hilarious to me. Like, it's just a great visual, because he looks like Droopy Dog with those eyes.
Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
Now, what
as
about
they slowly work its way down his cheeks to his mouth area?
Exactly.
It's like, are his eyes on his chin? What's going on?
Now, what about the fact that, and we haven't even talked about what Jack Kirby's initial Spider-Man costume looked like, but what about the fact that there's actually a bit of a controversy about where Ditko got his idea from? Like, you know, you were diligent in your research and found this great article from Newsarama from a few years back. And what did that article say, Dan?
Yeah, sure. There's this, a lot of controversy, like you said. There was this company called Ben Cooper in the 50s, and you may have heard of them. They created Halloween costumes for the longest time, up until like the mid-90s, where they sold their whole catalog to some of the other companies that are around today. But they were this New York based costume company, and they were, if you wanted a Halloween costume in the 50s and 60s, you knew Ben Cooper. That was the place to go. And in 1954, curiously enough, they put out their first Spider-Man costume. Now, some of you might be thinking, wait a minute, Spider-Man came out in 1962. How did they put out a Spider-Man costume in 1954? Well, that's exactly the point. They put out this costume. It was all yellow, but it featured a lot of the elements that are very similar to Steve Ditko's design. It had, the lens eyes that we're familiar with. It has a web pattern on the face radiating out from the nose and down the body. It's got a big spider emblem on the chest, and it's got, like, the solid colors on the arms and the legs. I mean, you couldn't look at this thing and not think that's Spider-Man with a hyphen. Their Spider-Man did not have a hyphen. I'll say that straight off the bat. That's the distinguishing difference. But here's the curious thing. Ben Cooper's had storefronts all throughout New York, including several that were right near Marvel's headquarters in New York. And their headquarters of Ben Cooper were actually not even 10 miles from Marvel's headquarters. And it was rumored that – and not even just rumored. It's known that Jack Kirby worked for Ben Cooper and designed a bunch of their costumes. We don't know if he designed the Spider-Man costume, but we know he did a bunch of the other ones. So it's not too big of a stretch to think that maybe, you know, Ditko was walking to work one day because he used to walk his pages to Marvel to drop them off at the office, you know, even when he was having a fight with Stan Lee. I don't think it's too much of a stretch that you could he would have maybe seen this costume in a storefront window, whether consciously or not, and drawn some kind of inspiration from it, or that Jack Kirby's early workings of this costume were similar to the one he may have designed for Ben Cooper. But here's where it gets really interesting. Spider-Man comes out. It's a big success. And in 1964, 2 years after it was created, Ben Cooper releases the first licensed Marvel product ever released. Like, there's no Fantastic Four products. There's no Hulk products. The first one ever is a Spider-Man costume. And Ben Cooper gets the deal to it. And it's not written down on paper, but there's been a number of people that have reported that Martin Goodman, you know, who was running Marvel at the time, and Ben Cooper met up and agreed that they wouldn't sue or find any kind of copyright things if Ben Cooper got access to the Spider-Man costume to sell. And it was one of their best sellers for years and years and years and years. So who could say if it was a good deal or not for them? Because they probably made a lot of money off of it, but they probably could be making billions off of it.
Right.
If it was actually could be found. So someone asked Steve Ditko about this.
Yeah, and I bet, you know, Ditko was always one willing to share credit, so I bet he was pretty good about this, right?
Oh, yeah, he was ecstatic about it. He's like, you found me. I love this. That's definitely where I got my inspiration from. No, actually, he said something very different. Mark, you have the quote. What did he say?
He says, the burden of proof is on the person who makes the assertion, claim, charge. Some clippings, etc., are not rational proof of anything but some clippings, etc. That is such a Ditko quote.
So I guess we'll never know. But in my mind, I mean, I'll have the picture in the podcast. I don't think you can see this and not draw a conclusion. I mean, it's so similar.
Right. Now, as for the whole Kirby thing, you know, it's interesting because, you know, Kirby gave an interview in the 80s to the Comics Journal where, you know, it's a very infamous interview for the industry where he completely savages Stan Lee and pretty much everything connected to Marvel. And, you know, among many claims he makes in that article is that he created Spider-Man. Whether we're talking about the costume here is neither here nor there, because the thing is, according to multiple books and sources and interviews, I mean, there's even pictures of it. Kirby, you know, Kirby did get the first crack at creating a Spider-Man character. That was, you know, Lee gave it to Kirby to start after Fantastic Four. And Kirby's first Spider-Man for the comics looked, outside of like the red and blue motif, looked, and the spider, like the spider insignia on the chest, looked nothing like neither this Ben Cooper costume or ultimately what Ditko ended up doing with it. If anything, I would say that this, you know, the original Kirby Spider-Man kind of just looks like Captain America with like goggles over his eyes.
Yeah, that's dead on.
And a gun. He had a gun. Like it was like, he, you know, like you see him like kind of like he's got like the Captain America from Avengers number 4, like charging into action. Motif going, but he's holding like a pistol, or like it actually looks like a space zapper, which I guess was where his like webbing was going to come from.
It does look like a space. I'm surprised that character didn't show up during Spider-Verse.
Yeah, right. You would think that would have made a. Was it in that huge Gabriel Delgado Spread. I don't even remember if that made it in there.
I don't even think Pete Ross made it in there. Which Pete Ross is the Marvel DC crossover character, and right. called Spider Boy, and he has a web gun.
So there you go.
There you go. The web gun made an appearance again.
Yeah. So it's so very interesting because obviously Kirby, you know, you would think that if Kirby was going to claim he created Spider-Man, he would have maybe have referenced, again, this Ben Cooper costume thing as part of the logic behind that. But he never really did. And instead, you know, without really elaborating on that, because it really is a kind of a vicious interview. It's kind of – I don't. Have you ever read it, Dan?
Yeah, and he's old. It just kind of seems like a guy who's in the twilight of his life lashing out.
It's kind of depressing to read. Yeah. I mean, even if you're like a huge – Kirby sympathists and think that Lee is a con man and a shyster, to me it's just depressing to read because no one looks good in the end. You know, one of those kind of interviews. But yeah, I mean, you know, I you don't get the sense that he's hanging his hat on Captain America Spider-Man either. So I don't. it is kind of curious to think, you know, was he thinking of the Ben Cooper thing and either because he didn't remember it or whatever, he just never said it specifically. So
yeah, well, it'll forever be shrouded in mystery. I Ditko is not talking either.
No,
or like and not talking in the way that we would find useful.
Right. And let's also not forget when it comes to the exterior of the costume, and then we're going to get into the physicality of the character. Good old web pits, which kind of come and go and come and go and come and go again, right?
Yeah. I mean, was there ever a functionality to these things? Like, I know the movie gave them kind of like gliding abilities, but I don't remember anybody ever in the comics coming up with a functionality for web pits.
No. No. I cannot think of a single issue where that happened. And I also don't feel like, I mean, as cool as it was to see, like, in the movie, them, like, acknowledging the existence of web pits, it's like, it's one of those things, like, even when you look at the first issue of Amazing Spider-Man with him, like, you know, on the cover with his arms spread out, it's kind of like, they look weird. Like he's a spider. He's not a bat. It makes him look like a bat. You know what I mean? Like, it never made sense to me, either from a practicality or even from a visual standpoint. Like, I'm you know, if this is me sounding like a, you know, a criminal for dissing the web pits, I apologize. But I just never really liked them.
Well, they definitely vary in size, too. Like, sometimes they'll be just in his armpits, and other times they're, like, full on wings. You know, and yeah, I prefer them. I like them, but I prefer them when they're small. I don't understand, like, sometimes they'd be like a greater wingspan than Peter himself.
Yeah, it's just weird. One of the many things that are never consistent about Spider-Man and Peter.
This is what we're finding out. Nothing stays the same.
Yeah. So, in terms of his actual powers and abilities, And Ditko's capturing, you know, aesthetic and the physicality of the character. I mean, let's run through this. You know, obviously, like spiders, he scales walls. He can leap high. He's got super strength, which is something that is questionable in terms of the consistency of that. More inconsistency.
Yeah, right. Like, he can crush... He can get knocked out by Aunt May hitting him over the head with a pot sometimes, and then the other times he's lifting cars up with one hand. I mean...
Yeah, I mean, in Annual 1, like, this line threw me. Like, I literally sat there slack-jawed when I read this. The text says, only Thor, the Hulk, and the Thing have greater strength. Of course, you know, this is 1964, so, I mean, like, the full stable of Marvel characters had not been fleshed out yet. But all the same, like, you know, like when you're thinking of like the Marvel powerhouses, Spider-Man is usually not in like the super, super strong sphere, right?
Well, even in the movies, I remember people like were a bit shocked when in Civil War, Spider-Man catches the Winter Soldier's arm as if it were nothing. And he's like, cool, you have a metal arm. And it's like, well, how powerful is Spider-Man? Is he stronger than Captain America?
And you would think yes, right?
Yeah, because throughout Winter Soldier, it's like proven that that arm is like stronger than Cap's shield or whatever. Like somehow Spider-Man is stopping that. Like, yeah, I mean, who could say just how strong he is?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty crazy, but I do love that that is a point that is kind of comes and goes at the convenience of the creative team. I always felt like both Roger Stern and Tom DeFalco were always very good at reminding the reader that he had the quote unquote proportionate strength of a spider, which to me is like, I mean, it's like an incredibly vague, unmeasurable expression, but
who's working but also, out spiders?
Yeah, but it's all, but it also works. Cause you know what I mean? Like, you know, like you see spiders. I mean, actually it's ants that are known as being like incredibly strong in terms of their size. But
right. Are spiders walking around asking each other, how much do you bench, bro?
you lift, bra? You skip to daddy log legs. You skipped leg day, didn't you?
All right, dad puns. Is that your superpower?
Well, one thing I liked also about the description of his powers in the annual is they talk about because he has this uncanny strength, in turn he has uncanny balance, which I actually kind of appreciate the physics of that because, I mean, not to now talk about my running, which is my other nerd thing. You know, they always tell you with a runner, like all of your power starts with like your core. Like, you know, it's not about being able to bench, but you got to have like a super core to be able to like have like balance and leg strength to run. So like, thinking about the fact that, you know, Peter is able to walk a tightrope because he's just got like super core strength and just super strength all over the place. I just appreciate the physics of that. I don't know. Maybe that's just me.
No, it's cool. I mean, I always think about the image from Amazing Fantasy 15 of him kind of like balancing on that wire. And it's like, maybe cool it down, dude. That's a bit risky. You're on top of a building. You just discovered these powers. You know, like... That's you're maybe taking on a little more than you can handle right now.
Yeah, I mean, because in the same vein, like you don't see like Thing or Hulk like walking a tightrope in any of the comics. So, I mean, the fact that he's, you know, able to kind of use his strength to do that is actually really impressive.
They're just waiting for the right time to whip out those skills.
Yeah. Now, in terms of the wall crawling, this thing gets me. So you know, Stan Lee, who, you know, you could say what you want to say about his role in the actual creation and physicality of the character. But, you know, the way he describes it is, you know, I saw a spider on the wall and I wanted to make a hero. Oh, no, he saw a fly on the wall. And that's when he said, I want to make a character who can climb a wall like that. So, like, that was always something that, like, was meant to be a part of what Spider-Man was going to become. So in terms of the scientific, if you will, and I'm making quote marks in the air here for those who, you know, can't see, which is everybody, quote unquote from the annual, his hands and feet support him against the pull of gravity as though they have thousands of tiny suction cups.
Specifically only his hands and feet.
Right. And this is, again, talk about inconsistency, because it's like, I just never feel like we have a true sense of what this wall clinging ability, how it tangibly happens. I mean, I always liked how in the Raimi movie it showed like the little like black, it almost looked like spikes that could dig into the walls, kind of a thing. You know what I mean?
Like the hair on his fingers.
Yeah, because that at least gave some tangibility to it, but you don't really get that sense in the comics. And like, there are some times where he can only do it if his shoes are off, other times, but like, it always works with his costume. I don't get it. What do you have any insights on this?
No, not really. I mean, my bigger question is like, in regard to like, does it give him leverage? Can he use it to hold onto the wall if he focuses on his hands? Like, there's those times, I think it's in like Ultimate Spider-Man, where like he gets frustrated and he like pulls the like drywall off the wall with his thing on his fingertips. Like, does it give him grip, or is he just like sticking to it? You know, like, It's a weird thing to think about, but, you know, something that would, I mean, it varies every time he uses it.
Yeah.
And later he would get the ability for his whole body to stick, and then that would go away a few issues later.
Yeah. Is that, are we talking about the other now? Or, Yeah, a lot of that went away. So in terms of his leaping ability, he can attain the average height of 3 stories with one bound. I didn't realize that was kind of the established limits of the leaping. And also he could jump the width of one city street, which is a long distance. I've never seen him really jump that far because he's got webbing. So why would he need to leap that far forward?
I'm sure that's like something, I mean, in the movie he does that, right? I mean, he leaps across the buildings in the movie.
Right.
Which is a pretty bold move.
Yeah. And he goes, I'm back. Oh, my back.
Well, if we want to talk about the most inconsistent thing of all, it's got to be the spider sense.
Well, right. Well, hold on. Just one more thing with the physicality. So I did find this very funny that apparently when Ditko took to this character and like had, you know, during Amazing Fantasy 15 had the pages of him crawling up the walls and like looking kind of gaunt and spidery, for lack of a, you know, using the description to describe the character. apparently, like Stan Lee, like, had this moment where he was wondering if like the comic code authority would sign off on this because like he thought it might violate the like at that point it was, you know, when the authority wouldn't sign off on humans that had monster type abilities like vampires and werewolves and things like that. So Lee was like, oh, you know, like we may not get the approval on this, but Ditko kind of made him stick to his guns, and it turned out not being a big deal. But that is just kind of a funny sidebar that Lee like almost like pulled the plug on the character because he just thought it went too far in terms of like looking kind of subhuman.
That's interesting.
Yeah. But spider sense. Talk about inconsistency, right?
Oh, yeah. It's all over the place. I mean, you can definitely get the sense throughout the Lee Ditko era that like they start off with this wide net of what spider sense can do and then slowly figure out what they feel like continues to be appropriate for spider sense, because one of the first real times we see him using it is to communicate with the chameleon. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, well, what's interesting, I mean, not to jump around a little bit, so apparently, and we talked about this on an episode of Spider Talk a few months ago, in one of the Ditko essays that I had read for research for the book, Ditko credits the origin of naming it or referring to it, at least in his conversations with Stan Lee, as spider sense and issue 2. Because there's this scene where he's, you know, looking for the vulture and the vulture's flying overhead and you see like little squiggly lines above his head, and Lee apparently like asked Ditko, well, what's this supposed to be? And he's like, oh, that's like his spider sense. It's like his sonar. And Lee was like, all right, sounds fine.
Whatever, Ditko.
Whatever, Steve. But you know, when we were reading issue 1 again for, you know, our last episode, I was like, yeah, there's this whole thing with the chameleon where the chameleon is like, I'll set up my radio waves to communicate to him. And it's like, what the hell is this then? And it's clearly spider sense, but it's not names that. And like, I mean, what was your takeaway from it?
I mean, it's truly bizarre. And then, you know, later on in that same issue, Spider-Man like tunes his spider sense, however he does that, so he can locate the helicopter that he's escaping in. Like, how bizarre.
And the thing that's so interesting about spider sense is, you know, in its own, it's one of those things that makes Spider-Man incredibly unique. I mean, you know, probably the only other character that has something similar is Daredevil with I mean, that's true sonar, I would say, right? I mean, is that a fair...
Doesn't he call it his, radar sense or whatever?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Although, I mean, it's supposed to be that he's got heightened, because he can't see, he has heightened other senses, and then, you know, over time, that kind of evolved to literally look like a bat sonar, you know what I mean? Like especially with Frank Miller.
Yeah.
But with Spider-Man, I mean, like, you know, my sense of spider sense, and not for nothing, I always felt that the ramifications of what spider sense looked like being turned off, that was best captured during Dan Slott's story a few years ago, kind of in the lead up to Spider Island. Because like there's even that one scene where he shoots a web and doesn't realize that like the facade of the wall of the building is crumbling, and he just like falls off the side of the wall.
I love that moment.
Because he can't sense it. And like that to me was always supposed to really, like, at the end of the day, that's where spider sense, that's to me is what true spider sense is. What, you know, regardless of the variations and radio waves and all the other things that come and go, I mean, I always think about it. It's something that warns him a split second before of imminent danger, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's inconsistently used. Like, there are times where, like, he's around a person who is dangerous and it triggers his spider sense, so it helps him, like, root out a criminal in a crowd or know that a scenario he's in is not a good one to be in. Whereas, like, other times I always think about the kid who collects Spider-Man where he pulled the bullets out of the wall and it allowed Spider-Man to dodge all those bullets, you know, because he knew exactly where they were going to go. And it tells him to kind of just jump out of the way. Like, that's how I think about spider-sense is duck, jump, do whatever, but wherever you're standing, something bad is about to happen. But yeah, it gets expanded to, like, that dude over there is a creep. My senses are telling me he's a creep.
Yeah, or even that, oh, I need to slip into my civvies. Oh, wait, you know, there might be a person in this alleyway. My spider sense is going off. You know what I mean? Or you know, the flip side of that, like the most recent storyline, the Osborn storyline in ASM, where, like, he's, like, chatting with Bobby Morse about being Spider-Man as Peter. And then, like, all of a sudden, like, Aunt May and Harry are on the plane. And you're kind of like, wouldn't his spider sense have been going off if he was being so cavalier about his identity? You know what I mean? Like, talk about the inconsistencies of it.
Yeah. He also, like, you know, there's been times, especially in this early, like, Ditko run, where you're talking about Daredevil. There's times where Spider-Man kind of has used his spider sense, like Daredevil's advanced hearing, where Daredevil just tried to, like, listen over the whole city, you know?
Yeah.
And Spider-Man would, like, get on a rooftop and see where his senses, you know, led him. This is, like, pre-Spider-Tracer, and I'm sure it was just a way, you know, for them to find a way to get Spider-Man to some scene of the crime, because he doesn't have, like, Superman's ability to fly everywhere, and he wasn't really a part of the Daily Bugle yet. So the senses kind of, like, were a stand-in for, here's what's happening in the city. You got to go stop the crime.
Yeah. Or then sometimes it becomes like, you know, the Star Wars, like, Jedi force. Because, like, I think back to, and when we interviewed him as well about it, he mentioned this, you know, David Morrell in the Spider-Man Frost story, where he was talking about how, like, you know, Spider-Man was just able to sense that his Aunt May was in trouble, and that's how he was, like, trying to trudge across town in the blizzard to find her. And you're just kind of like, I never got a sense that's how it works. You know what I mean? Like, like, that seems a little, you know, he's not Luke Skywalker being, you know, like, I just heard a thousand or a million screams go silent. Or I know that's not Luke, it's Obi-Wan. You can correct me.
My Shame spider paranoia is going off.
There you go.
Well, speaking of spider sense, we're talking about the spider tracer.
Yeah. So the tracer first appeared in its tangible form in Amazing Spider-Man number 11. That's the two-parter with Doc Ock, and where Betty Brant's brother gets killed at the end of it. When he invents it, he describes it as a quote-unquote detailed model of a live spider, except for the transistorized circuits I've installed inside. No matter where it is, it will send back coded messages to me, which I can pick up with my small portable receiver. And you're just kind of like, WTF? How did this kid invent that? And where does he get the technology for it? He's a poor kid from Queens.
Yeah, right. For all of his moaning about having no money, this kid is finding some high tech gear.
Yeah, like sending back coded messages. I mean, I'm gonna put this out there, Dan. To me, like, I find the spider tracers to be pretty dumb.
I like the spider tracer. I'm gonna stand up to you on that one.
Okay. I mean, like to me, it's just, I don't know. Like, he doesn't need this. Like, it's just like. But just without having an argument of merits on something that is completely fantastical, it's worth noting. So, you know, for the most part in the beginning, the spider tracer was, you know, he used a receiver to trace it. And then somewhere, I couldn't confirm this exactly, but according to like one of the Marvel Wikia sites, they cited Amazing Spider-Man number 53 as the first time where he just used his spider sense to track the tracer, not the radio. And that sounds about right.
I was going to say, I don't think it really shows up for a long time. It kind of goes away and then comes back around then.
Right. And then kind of more to that point, one thing I always appreciated was he would go back to the transistor, the radio, when he needed to track something over a longer distance, like for a commuter cometh, where, you know, obviously the guy is like out of the city, he's in Westchester. So he goes and he pulls out the little radio to find him on the metro, you know, going back towards the suburbs. So that's kind of, you know, so if he is just using spider sense, it's got to be for a short distance of like, what, a couple of hundred feet, I think, is what they establish.
Well, there were those like pre-GPS days where Spider-Man would literally go, I'm going to go swing around the city until I pick up traces of my spider tracer on this guy. And you just imagine a guy going like grid style through Manhattan just trying to find this little thing he planted.
First we'll go down 7th Avenue, now we'll go down 8th Avenue.
I do want to say, though, the original design is really funny because it looks like an actual spider, but like I love the stuff during Bagley's run where it kind of became like this, his back symbol. And this kind of like cute little spider tracer. I always think about the artwork of like Venom, you know, noticing it and then crunching it with its tendrils, you know, like this, this poor cute little spider just being smashed.
Anything else on spider senses and tracers you want to talk about?
I like the tracers. I'm going to stand up for the tracers.
Like I said, I just find them completely unnecessary and very deus machina. I mean, you know, like, again, we're already talking about someone who can climb on walls and can sense danger and can crush pipes and apparently is as strong as some of the strongest characters. I don't understand why he needs to, like, you know, have GPS trackers around, but whatever.
will you say that they're at least better than his new, like, subdermal tracers that get under your skin?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
All right.
But in terms of tech that Peter created, I mean, the one thing that's been there since Amazing Fantasy number 15, which to me remains like one of the most amazing inventions that any Marvel character has come up with themselves, is the web shooters, of course, and web formula, because it's kind of hand in hand. What do you think about web shooters, Dan? You're not going to diss the web shooters, right?
No, the web shooters are every kid's dream. I mean, you got to get a hold of these things. They're the best part of his powers, and they're not even part of his powers.
Yeah, I mean, well, to me, that shows the power that happened pre-Spider, you know, before Spider-Bite, which is Peter's intellect. Because, I don't know, like, you know, we're joking about, like, you know, where he gets the materials for coded, you know, sending coded messages to transistor radios. But, like, for whatever reason, because this was just there from the get-go, I do get the sense that he just kind of foraged around in his bedroom and found the equipment to do this. Like, I don't know. That's I could suspend the disbelief that he just had the crap lying around and did it.
Has anybody ever written a story where he didn't get bit by a spider but still invented the web shooters anyway? And there's just this like unathletic dorky kid swinging around town, getting hurt by these web shooters.
That sounds about well. I could be wrong, but I think there might have been something with there was a what if where it was three different characters getting bitten by the spider, and I think Flash Thompson got bit, and because he wasn't smart enough to invent the web shooters, like he ended up getting like killed on the job because. he had the powers, but didn't know how to use them, basically.
I thought you were going to say he farmed them out by beating up Peter Parker and demanding, instead of lunch money, you can make me web shooters.
I might be misremembering that, but I'm pretty sure that, like, he didn't have it. I know that Flash in his story dies at the end, and I think that had something to do with it. Like, he wasn't smart enough to make the web shooters. You know, in typical Stan Lee hyperbole, in AS Manual number 1, when they're going over the web shooters, it's described as, well, for web formula, Peter, how did Peter create web formula? Well, he is, quote unquote, probably the world's greatest authority on the subject of webs and their creation.
He's doing a lot of science projects on spiders and webs, apparently.
Yes. The comic also notes that formula is a, quote unquote, closely guarded secret, but he uses the most exacting conditions in his home lab and stores it in small cylinders like toothpaste. I mean, that does kind of strain credibility a little bit that, what are these exacting conditions in his home bedroom were like?
Cold fusion.
Where like Aunt May is constantly walking in with like cookies and milk, but like he can create web. Stay out. I'm just being a mad scientist, Aunt May.
I guess it's a little better than doing it in the drawer at school, like in Spider-Man Homecoming.
Yes, yeah.
One of the things that I've always loved about the web shooters is the exact hand pattern that he has to use to trigger it. I mean, they have a little bit of fun with it in the original Spider-Man movie, but I always used to make that hand pattern, and I can't really think of another like hero that has something like that other than maybe like Doctor Strange with his weird hand stuff, but like it's almost like universal. If you make that symbol, everybody knows that's Spider-Man's thing.
Yeah, it's thwip thwip, right? I mean,
Yeah, he's also got a sound effect that's like his own thing. Him and Wolverine have got snick and thwip.
Snick it and thwip. When they talk about the mechanics in the annual, they quote it as, "It's worn on his wrist and activated by the slightest touch of his finger upon the super sensitive electrode located at the palm of his hand."
That's some pretty sophisticated stuff.
Yeah, which makes sense. And apparently, I don't think I realized this, there are three nozzle settings. There's a thin, strong line, just to shoot a line, to grab onto a building. There's fine quick spray, which is for the Spider-Man parachute net, which we saw a few times during Lee Ditko. And then a thick adhesive liquid, like a glue goppy stuff, which I guess is like for when he like captures villains, or like does the web balls in Doc Ock's eyes. Because he's the only one who gets the web balls in the eyes.
And then there's all those crazy things that he can make it into.
Yes. They show him. He makes a shield, a parachute, a safety net, skis, a raft, a club, a ball of just old sticky glue. But, I mean, did we actually ever see any of these things?
I don't think so. But spider skis, like, have got to happen. Like, where are the spider skis?
I mean, we just had that whole storyline where he was like in the snowy mountains fighting Norman Osborn. Why didn't we have spider skis?
Perfect time for web skis.
Yeah. Also, just a thing to note, it is strong enough to hold the thing and fireproof. So, again, when he has his fights with Johnny Storm, it's like and also very elastic, although the annual notes that it's not quite as elastic as Mr. Fantastic. So apparently, like, all gets gauged against the Fantastic Four.
That's all that there was to gauge it against.
And as has been noted dozens of times in the comics, it disappears after 1 hour. Or dissolves.
Leaving his clothes up on a roof somewhere.
Yes. So, pretty cool, right?
I love the web shooters. They're the best.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I mean, Peter very openly acknowledges throughout this run as, you know, the web shooters being great. In Amazing Spider-Man number 7, in one line, he refers to them as, quote-unquote, being the greatest thing I ever dreamed up. So...
And web swinging is great, too. I mean, that's the kind of thing you always dreamed about before he ever came to the big screen or was ever animated. Like, how would this guy move? What would that look like? I always would think about it when I walked through New York City. Like, what would it actually be like to see a guy swinging through the buildings? It's just such a cool thing. Way cooler than flying.
Yeah. And, like, creating it. Visually, like in the movies, I mean, like they talked about the spider cams that Raimi used, like were these like cameras that they would crane up like 200 feet on a zip line and like drop them up and down. I mean, like that's, I mean, really kind of crazy stuff to be doing with cameras. But like, I think that captured it visually, right?
Yeah, absolutely. That, or they were using the spider mannequin to make it happen.
Yeah.
Okay, so I went to bat for the spider tracers. I am not going to go to bat for this next ability of Spider-Man's. You can't forget about the spider signal, or maybe you can.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's funny like that. That, you know, the spider signal showed up in like one of the teasers at the end of Civil War, and like it was supposed to be like this really awesome thing of look, it's the spider signal. But I'm like, has there ever really been a tangible use for it? I mean, like, because he's not, I mean, to me, it just screams Batman, you know, like it's the bat signal. But, you know, that had a tangible use that was used by Gotham police to alert Batman to that they need him. Right. I mean, that seems pretty logical. Right.
Yeah. We did get that in the Superior Spider-Man era.
Yeah.
But that was an obvious joke about Batman.
Right. Yeah. But it's basically just him, like, I mean, you know, we always joke that Spider-Man kind of has this, you know, when Peter is Spider-Man, he kind of takes on a more extroverted personality, and, you know, he's more jokey and more cocky and confident. So he uses the spider tracer to kind of like announce his presence and like, hey, guys, I'm about to kick your butt, which is, I guess, kind of funny, but there's no other use for them beyond that.
Sometimes he would use it to like illuminate dark spaces and like guide himself through things. And then later in Amazing Spider-Man 675, he got like a second mode for it where it switched it into like UV light, and he used it for forensic purposes. So every time Spider-Man goes to a hotel room, he's sure to use that spider belt to figure out where he's been.
You made the hotel room joke, because I was right there. We were simpatico on that one.
I think for me, the places that I think it's most interesting is that, first of all, like, it kind of was the first appearance of that like Spider-Man eye symbol that like Carly Cooper would later get tattooed on her. And right. You know, it was on a bunch of the covers for a little while. Like, I'm thinking of Amazing Spider-Man 22, that the clown and the Masters of Menace story that is unforgettable. Oh, who could forget the Masters of Menace?
Hey, it's another Ringmaster story.
Yeah. but on that
and
cover,
Princess Python, come on.
Yeah. And I think about that Vulture cover with the eyes. That's really unforgettable.
You mean 63? That's my first Silver Age issue, so I will always remember that.
Yeah, that one's great.
You're talking with the two vultures, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, there's that one, and then there's the one with the vulture in the brick wall.
Oh, right.
That one's
great, too. Yeah, so I'm not about to fight you on your dissing of the spider signal. You know, one thing, you know, in talking about, and those are more or less the base powers and gadgets from Lee Ditko, but, you know, one thing we got to talk about here is, like, you know, like it kind of like playing to the idea that Spider-Man is more of like this thinking man character is he always kind of seems to be talking about his powers and his gadgets and his limits and using them. Or he's like improvising off of them. Like I always think with Electro, he makes like, you know, like shockproof webbing, or he like webs up his hands for protection and stuff like that. Like it just shows like him thinking many steps ahead and always kind of being in his head as well, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, or someone will crush the web shooter, or he'll – how many times does he run out of web cartridges? Like,
right.
I think to the point that no one's allowed to use that plot device anymore because yeah. It's so overdone. I mean, when was the last time he ran out of web cartridges? A while ago, because it was so overused.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, there were definitely, I think that was a shooterism. Like, he can't run out of, you know, shooters, like things was you can't kill Aunt May and you can't get rid, you can't run out of web fluid.
Yeah. But another interesting thing about the Dicko run is that, like, most of his villains, like, their way of, like, defeating him the first time would be they would take away one of his powers, whether because he was sick or the Goblin used some kind of smoke bomb that removed his spider sense. We actually saw that just a couple months ago in the modern Amazing Spider-Man.
Right.
Like, this is something that was continually done. Like, you can't use this power, so how do you compensate for that?
Right, right. Yeah, like, you know, he couldn't punch out Sandman because Sandman kept changing his mass and density. Or, yeah, I mean, it's you know, and again, it just demonstrates how Peter, beyond being having these great abilities, I mean, perhaps to not to render this all moot, but perhaps his best ability is the one that he had regardless of the spider bite, which is his intellect.
Yeah, absolutely. So we talked about last episode that, like, we think the reason we really like the character of Spider-Man is because of Peter Parker. But I think, like, in the terms of, like, superheroes, he also has a really cool power set.
Oh, absolutely. And it's very unique and distinct. It's not just that he's strong. It's not just that he, you know, I mean, the gadgets are great. I mean, outside of Iron Man, who's got cool gadgets like this, you know, like, and it seems like, you know, whether intentional or not, like, all of his abilities are kind of out there to counter or complement other heroes' abilities. I mean, you know, even the fact that they're like kind of gauging all of his things against the Fantastic Four. Like, oh, he can hold the thing and it's elastic for Mr. Fantastic and it's fireproof for Human Torch. And I feel like we see that a lot. And it kind of plays also to Spider-Man being a loner and kind of being outcast and a misfit. This idea that, you know, like, not that he's trying to go against the other heroes, but if he ever chose to go down that path, he would have the means to take on a lot of these other characters in the Marvel Universe.
Or fight all of the X-Men in Secret Wars.
Yeah, well, yeah. That was just awesome.
Well, that's a great way of putting it, Mark. Why don't you take us home here?
Yeah, well, thanks for joining us for our third episode of the first season of the all-new Amazing Spider Talk. Dan, our next episode will be out on 2 weeks on August 16th. And what's the title for that show?
Yeah, that show is going to be called If This Be Spider-Man's Destiny.
Ooh.
Yeah, we're going to be breaking down all of the reoccurring tropes that are destined to show up in Spider-Man comics and movies for as long as they're continuing to make them. That means lifting things over his head, the Parker luck. I mean, you name it. There are things from this run that will echo on forever.
Spider-Man quitting.
Yeah, that's another one of them. So we'll save some of them for the show, but that's what we're going to be talking about.
You got it. You got it. Also, for our Patreon subscribers, be sure to check out our Patreon page and your podcast feed for this week's bonus episode. This time we're going to be talking about all the Spider news out of San Diego Comic-Con, what we think will happen when Peter rejoins the Daily Bugle in Amazing Spider-Man, and our thoughts on the return of John Watts to the Spider-Man Homecoming franchise, its sequel. And remember, for just $3.99 a month, the price of a new comic, you'll get access to all of these exclusive new issue reviews, B-book reviews, news items, mailbags, etc., etc. And then for $10 or more a month, you'll get access to commissioned artwork.
Well, speaking of that commissioned artwork, Mark, I'm excited that I get to announce who's doing our first one. And it's none other than Ron Friend, a good friend of the show. He's going to be doing our first commissioned art prints for the members of our club. So I'll be working together with Ron to cook up something extra special for all of our faithful patrons. So I can't wait to debut what that artwork is. But if you want to get some Ron Friend's artwork in the mail, you can do it by signing up for our club.
That's awesome, Dan. I'm very excited. So, Dan, where can we find you on the World Wide Web?
Yeah, of course, you can find me on Twitter at sup. Spider Talk, and you can find all of my writing for all the new reviews of the Amazing Spider-Man issues over on SuperiorSpiderTalk.com. What about you, Mark? What have you been up to this week?
Yeah, well, I've admittedly have not been writing as much lately, but when I am writing, you can find me on Chasing Amazing Blog and SuperiorSpiderTalk.com, and of course, you can find 330 some odd pages of my writing in bookstores everywhere and online book vendors. And the book is called 100 Things Spider-Man Fans Should Know and Do Before They Die by Triumph Books. Get your copy today. And if you get it and read it and like it, or even if you don't like it, leave me a review on wherever you bought it from to help the visibility of the book.
What about your Twitter account?
Oh, yeah, Twitter. Thanks, Dan. You can find me at ChasingASMBlog. Did you say your Twitter account? Or
I did, Mark.
Oh, God. That shows how well I listen to you.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Oh, God.
You know, Mark, powers aren't everything. You know, they're sometimes you have all this power, and you need some kind of motto to help you keep it in line. What motto might that be?
Well, that motto might be, with great podcasts must also come the all-new Amazing Spider Talk.